So I'm going to start by saying something about Lee Walters. He is the co-author of this paper, you see. Some of you may know his groundbreaking work on counterfactuals. He's a very senior philosopher, in one sense, at the University of Southampton. And so we've collaborated here, and what I'm presenting is based on that work. Okay? So I'm going to talk about the argument from illusion, and the label, the argument from illusion, covers quite a lot of things in different works and different areas of philosophy. But don't be confused by that, because what I mean is just something very specific in the philosophy of perception, and there's some literature on that. And so that's my only focus here, not the argument from illusion more generally. The way I see the argument is that it poses a challenge to a view of reality and our relationship to it called common sense realism. And by that I just mean the claim that we are sometimes aware in perceptual experience of mind-independent material objects, which I'll just call ordinary objects. Okay? So the conclusion of the argument, if it works, the conclusion shows that common sense realism is false. The argument argues that we're never aware of ordinary objects in perceptual experience. And what I want to do here is two things. First of all, I want to look at how the argument gets formulated in the literature, its canonical formulation, and show that the argument is invalid as so formulated. But the substantive point that lies behind that is that we need to recognize an extra premise which the argument relies on. And then I'm going to try and suggest that the premise is contentious. I'm afraid I can't argue that the premise is false. I do actually think it's false, but I don't have any arguments for that strong conclusion, so I'm going with contentious. Okay. So the argument from illusion gets discussed and in some cases proposed, endorsed, in early 20th century writings on the philosophy of perception, G.E. Moore and C.D. Broad, maybe Russell and some others in that tradition. But it gets formulated in more robust terms, more rigorously, in more contemporary work, work by Paul Snowden, and then Howard Robinson, A.D. Smith, and Tim Crane. And the formulation I'm going with here is what we find in the works of the latter three authors, Robinson, Smith, and Crane. It's useful in understanding the argument to see it as having a two-stage structure, and this comes from Paul Snowden. In the first stage, which is called the base case stage, what the aim is to establish a claim just about illusory experiences. Specifically, the claim that I'm calling the interim negative claim, that in cases of illusion, one is never aware of an ordinary object. And then in the second stage, the spreading step stage, the arguer from illusion tries to generalize beyond that case to get us to the negative claim that one is never perceptually aware of an ordinary object. Or to put it another way, one is never aware of an ordinary object in perceptual experience. So that's, in broad terms, how the argument's supposed to work. We start with a claim about illusions, and then we spread that and generalize that to veridical cases so that we get the result that we're never aware of ordinary objects. And the background assumption is that if we are aware of ordinary objects, it's only through illusions or veridical cases, where awareness is understood in terms of perceptual awareness throughout. So let me run through the argument as it is in this formulaic presentation on page one, and then a bit later we'll go through it with an example so that it's perhaps easier to grasp. Okay, so the first premise is when one is subject to an illusory experience, there sensibly appears to one to be something which has a sensible quality, F, which the ordinary object supposedly being perceived doesn't have. So, for instance, this apple is green and reddish. An illusory experience of it would be one in which I see it, but it appears bright pink. Although I learned yesterday that some students taking experimental psychology are being told by the experimental psychologist that there is no such thing as colour. So perhaps that's not a good example. On the other hand, you could just disagree with the experimental psychologists, which I think is what I'm inclined to do. anyway, so that's the first premise. The second premise is a principle, the phenomenal principle. When in perceptual experience it sensibly appears to one that something has a sensible quality F, then there is something of which one is aware which does have this quality. And it's supposed to follow from this, and this is what I'm going to challenge, that in cases of illusion, one's not aware of the ordinary object. And having established that interim claim, we'd say, well, we have to give the same account of illusions and veridical cases. So even in those veridical cases, one's not aware of an ordinary object. And so one's never perceptually aware of an ordinary object. That's the negative claim. As I say, we'll go through that more slowly with an example soon. One thing I want to put aside, often this argument is formulated in terms of direct awareness. So you would plug direct before each occurrence of awareness. But nothing I say here is going to hang on how we formulate it, whether direct or just in terms of awareness. So I'm going to leave that aside. And I think you may have already noticed that the argument should be viewed as controversial in both of its stages. The spreading step is not obviously correct. As a form of disjunctivism which says, well, hold on, I want to give a different account of illusions to what I'm saying about veridical cases. So one could attempt to block the argument there. I don't myself think that's very plausible, but I'm going to set such considerations aside because the focus here will just be on the base case stage. That's what I want to target. But that stage is controversial too, because it consists in, well, substantively, just this phenomenal principle. And the phenomenal principle is a consequence of and reflects the sense datum theory of experience. And there are very few sense datum theorists around these days. It's discredited, apparently. So we might want to reject the phenomenal principle. So I certainly don't want to suggest the phenomenal principle is true. But part of what I'm up to here is to say we can grant it and the argument still isn't going to work. But let me just say a bit more about the phenomenal principle and the sense datum theory which underpins it, because that will be relevant to some of our discussion later. Okay. So I'm formulating the sense datum theory in minimal terms. And I've put it like this on page 2 of the handout. A perceptual experience in which it sensibly appears to S as if something has some sensible quality F consists in a relation of sensory awareness or acquaintance apprehension, whatever you want to plug in there, between S and something which is F. And this thing is called a sense datum. So this is a view of experience on which experiences consist in relations between perceivers and things. And the things that perceivers are related to have the qualities, they instantiate the qualities which characterize the experience. So if I see this apple as red and green, and redness and greenness qualify characterize the experience I have, then the sense datum theorist says, well, I'm therefore related to something which is red and green. The character of my experience is inherited from the characteristics, the qualities of the objects I'm aware of in experience. So the phenomenal principle is supposed to reflect this sort of theory of experience. And we can reword it just by plugging the term sense datum into it to make that clear. So when in perceptual experience it sensibly appears to one that something has a sensible quality F, then there is something, a sense datum, of which one is aware which does have this quality. Okay? Before moving on, I want to just be very clear that we shouldn't understand sense datum, the term sense datum and sense data in this context as some mysterious sort of entity. There's simply no warrant for that understanding of sense data here. I think the way to see that is to note that as it occurs in this discussion, the term sense datum is a functional term. It just labels something which plays a particular role, anything which plays the role. So it's not a substantive term. It doesn't name something with specific conditions which mark out a kind, a substantial kind. So it's a label for something which plays a particular role. That is, the sense datum in an experience in which it appears to one as if something is F is just whatever it is that one's aware of which has this quality. That's what the phenomenal principle entitles us to say about sense data, just taken on its own. In other words, we can say of sense data that they satisfy these two conditions. They're things capable of bearing sensible qualities, and they're things capable of being objects of awareness. But those two conditions don't mark out a substantive kind. All sorts of things can be sense data in those terms, right? You know, an apple could be a sense datum. So could a car. So could a badger. All sorts of things. So could something mind-dependent, something non-physical, right? I mean, these conditions just don't mark out some sort of entity for us to start worrying about. Okay? So that's a point about the phenomenal principle and what it does and doesn't warrant us to say. It does introduce sense data into our discussion, but it doesn't introduce some kind of thing in some interesting sense. So to make this clear, if you apply the phenomenal principle just to a veridical case, well, when I see the apple for what it is in respect of colour, for the green and red thing it is, well, phenomenal principle says that means I'm aware of, I'm related to something which is green and red. Well, that may as well just be the apple. Okay? So applying the phenomenal principle to veridical cases doesn't take us beyond a common sense realist perspective on perception. So we're in a position that Price was in when he introduced sense data into his discussion. He was very clear about this point, and he said this: we're not committed to any view about what is called the status of sense data in the universe, either as regards the category they fall under or as regards their relations with other types of existent entities. They may be physical, i.e. they may be parts of or events in material objects such as chairs and tables, or in another theory, brains. They may be mental, as Berkeley and others have held. They may be neither physical nor mental. So we have a relatively neutral or functional or metaphysically thin notion of a sense datum in play here, okay? So now what I want to do, having said that much by way of background material, is consider how the argument is supposed to work with a certain example. And I'm just focusing on the base case stage. So the example I have in mind I'm calling Bob's illusion, and it's a case where you have a perceiver, Bob, who sees a uniformly white wall as yellow. Perhaps the wall is bathed in yellow light, or perhaps there's been some interference in Bob's brain, but that's how he sees the white wall. Okay, that's the illusion we're working with here. Now, what our contemporary expositors of the argument tell us is that it works very simply. We have the first and second premise, the base case stage, and we apply Leibniz's law, and then the interim negative claim is supposed to follow. That's what Robinson and Smith say, and as does Tim Crane following them. But if we run that through, we can see that it simply doesn't work. So premise one would be Bob has an illusory experience of a white wall as yellow. We apply the phenomenal principle and conclude, in the illusory experience, Bob is aware of a yellow sense datum. Fine. Does it follow then that Bob is not aware of the wall? It doesn't follow. What's being muddled up here are two claims, namely Bob is aware of something which is not the wall, and Bob is not aware of the wall. So what actually follows from our premises is what I've put as 3-star on the handout. In the illusory experience, the yellow sense datum Bob is aware of is not the wall. But for all that, Bob might also be aware of the wall. So all the argument as we have it, and if we add Leibniz's law into the mix, entitles us to conclude is that in the illusion, Bob is aware of something, a yellow sense datum, which is not identical to the ordinary object, the wall. The non-identity claim follows from Leibniz's law and the fact that the ordinary object and the sense datum have different qualities. But that doesn't entail that Bob's not also aware of the wall. It doesn't entail that Bob's not aware of the sense datum and the wall. Okay? So that's to put the problem with respect to the example, but more generally, the issue of invalidity here is that the interim negative claim doesn't follow from the premises of the argument. What follows, rather, is that in an illusion, one is aware of an F thing, which is not the ordinary object. Consistently with this, one may also be aware of the ordinary object. Now, this is interesting because it forces us to look for what premise we need to plug in to make the argument work. And what we find, I'm going to suggest then, is an extra premise which actually is controversial. And it's not obviously true, and it's not clear how we can argue for it. So the fix I have in mind, I'm sure there could be other ways of doing it, but the one I'm going to hone in on here is to say we add this assumption or this premise. I'm on page 4 now. So to be clear, what we want to do is get from 3-star in the illusion the yellow sense datum Bob is aware of is not the wall to 3. Bob is not aware of the wall. So one way to do that would be to say, well, because Bob is aware of the sense datum, non-identical to the wall, he's not also aware of the wall. In other words, awareness of the sense datum somehow excludes awareness of the wall. You have some sort of exclusion assumption in place. Without that, the argument doesn't go through. I think this is interesting because it reveals or it brings out another way the argument can fail, because it's already contentious. We've already got the spreading step, which many reject. We've already got the phenomenal principle, which many reject. But now we have to recognize an extra assumption, which we might want to reject too. And in fact, it reveals that we could reject the argument whilst maintaining the phenomenal principle and the spreading step. So we could hold on to the sense datum theory and still discredit the argument from illusion if we found a way to reject the exclusion assumption. Now, I'm not going to give you a way to reject the exclusion assumption, but I am going to try to discredit it by discussing how it's not obvious and how at least one argument for it should fail. So two initial points is that it's not logically incoherent or problematic to deny the exclusion assumption. We could say, and it seems perfectly logical to say, that illusions are cases where one is aware of both the material object, a wall, and the yellow sense datum. That doesn't seem to be logically repugnant. Another point is, you can imagine someone wanting to explain illusions in a way that requires us to reject the exclusion assumption. Because if you think about illusions, there are two elements to them which are salient here. One is that we're aware of an object, an ordinary object, And the other is that you're aware of, or apparently aware of, a quality that it doesn't have. So one way to explain them would be to say, look, there's an awareness of the object element, an awareness of a sense datum element, and then some blending, and that's how you get the character that illusions have. I'm not recommending that or saying it would be easy to do, but we shouldn't just assume that such an explanatory approach is bound to fail. But such an approach requires we reject the exclusion assumption here. So I'm just trying to loosen you up for the idea that actually the exclusion assumption, you know, shouldn't just be taken for granted. So what we need to do now then is consider how we might try to argue for the exclusion assumption, to fix up the argument even more substantively. What considerations can we put forward to suggest that we should hold to the exclusion assumption? Well, this is why I have these props. I'm sorry, on the handout it says apple and orange, but I don't have any oranges, so this will have to do. Okay, if we think about a mundane exclusion assumption. So I put this apple here. Now consider this, just the space defined in terms of that apple, right? And I see apple 1 there. In that space, I don't see apple 2, right? And we want to say my seeing apple 1, my awareness of apple 1, excludes my awareness of apple 2 in that space. Why? Well, one answer is because they spatially exclude one another. The reason I'm aware of apple 1 there and not apple 2 is because they can't be co-located, right? That's one way to justify such an exclusion assumption. Now, I take it we don't want to pursue that line of thought here, because that would make us say, in illusions, Bob is aware of a sense datum which displaces the wall. Now, that would be odd. We'd have to question, well, where's the wall then? Or is there a wall? So the displacement model, I don't think, is a non-starter, I think. You may disagree. But here's then another model for such an exclusion assumption. Okay. From my point of view, I can't see apple 2. Why? Well, because I see apple 1, and it occludes apple 2. Okay? Maybe, I can't get this right from the perspective, but you understand occlusion, I hope. So it blocks it from view. It doesn't displace it. They're in different spaces, fine. Or it does displace it, but that's not the rationale for saying that awareness of one excludes awareness of the other. Okay, it's occlusion. So now we might wonder, so perhaps Bob's awareness of the sense datum in the illusion occludes from view. It blocks from view the wall, and that's why Bob is not aware of both. That's why, in being aware of the sense datum, he's not also aware of the wall, and that's the exclusion assumption we're trying to justify. But it's not evident that the sense datum occludes the wall, so that needs argument, and that's what I'm going to try and give now. So I'm on page 5 now, and this is called the argument from opacity. So I'm now arguing on behalf of the arguer from illusion, on behalf of the sense datum theorist, for why awareness of the sense datum should exclude awareness of the wall. So we can challenge the sense datum theorist with this question. This is a long-winded question, as many questions in philosophy are. So consider a case where one sees an object through a transparent medium and where one also sees the medium itself. For instance, seeing an apple on the table through a beam of light, through a shadow, a hologram, a stretch of cling film, or if you're an American, saran wrap, or a pane of coloured glass. Okay? So you've got a transparent medium through which you see an object, but you also see the medium itself. Okay? So take the latter case. Suppose we would put some coloured glass between the apple and my view of the apple. Well, then I could see the apple through the glass, and the glass itself and its character, its qualities would contribute to my experience, so would the apple. So we might say, why is the sense datum in Bob's case not like that? It's transparent. It doesn't occlude the wall. It's something one sees and sees through to the wall. Why not think in those terms? So I'm going to give, just to make the discussion a bit easier, I'm going to give the sense datum this name, D. Okay? Not very inventive, but there you go. So the question is, Bob is aware in his illusion of D, this yellow sense datum. Why is his awareness of D something which excludes awareness of the wall? And we're framing that in terms of, why should we think that D is occluding? Why not think of D as transparent? Okay? And the argument from opacity is an argument which gets us to the conclusion that D is opaque. And here's the argument. We reflect upon the character of Bob's experience more fully than we have so far, and apply the phenomenal principle. So in Bob's illusion, the wall looks yellow to him, but it also looks opaque to him. Okay? So it's a case where something sensibly appears to be yellow and opaque. By the phenomenal principle, Bob is thus aware of something which is yellow and opaque, a yellow and opaque sense datum, D. So by the phenomenal principle and the facts about the case, we can establish that this sense datum is opaque. And we also know that Bob is aware of, he sees the sense datum. Well, if he sees an opaque thing, he doesn't also see the wall because it's opaque, and so it must occlude the wall from view. There's a background assumption here, which is that Bob's view, his seeing, his awareness of the sense datum is in a certain region of space, which is where he would see the wall if he did see the wall. And I think we can grant that. So given that the sense datum is opaque, given that it has that property, that's why this is the grounds for saying that the exclusion assumption holds. That's why, in being aware of the sense datum, Bob's not also aware of the wall. So this is the argument from opacity, and it's supposed to give us the grounds for the exclusion assumption, so that the argument from illusion, assuming the other premises are okay, can go through. So the final part of the talk then is just going to be a way of resisting the argument from opacity, which won't show the exclusion assumption is false, but it will undermine this argument we've just considered for it. Okay? The way to undermine it is to say, well, look, we can agree that the sense datum is opaque, fine, but we can deny that that means it occludes the wall. What I'm going to say is, grant everything we've said so far, Bob's aware of a sense datum in a certain region of space, and it's opaque. And now I want to say that does not entail that he's not aware of the wall. So one thing that's working here is the D, the sense datum, is non-identical to the wall. That's because the sense datum has a quality the wall doesn't have. The sense datum is opaque, but it's also yellow. The wall is opaque, but it's not yellow. It's white. So we have grounds for a non-identity claim. Okay. But we need more than that for the argument to work. We need the claim that the sense datum and the wall are wholly distinct. And that's what we haven't had any argument for, what we haven't got grounds for, in fact, I think. So we could conceive of the sense datum as being a composite object, D as a composite object, which is composed of the yellow sense datum, what we can call an elementary sense datum, and the wall. Because of its composite nature and the qualities of the wall and the sense datum, D is opaque and yellow. But it's a composite of the wall and something else. So even though it's opaque, there's no reason at all to think that awareness of it will occlude the wall. The wall is part of it in some sense. Unless we can rule that out, the argument from opacity is not going to work. So think about this case. You have a Rubik's Cube. I don't have one myself. I can't do them. But suppose you know what they look like, I hope. So it's an object which is composed of constituent cubes, right? And it's opaque, let's suppose. The Rubik's Cube is opaque. But looking at that doesn't exclude awareness of the constituent parts. So that's a case where you're aware of something which is opaque, but which doesn't occlude other things because they're parts of it, right? So my point is, unless we've got grounds to think that D, the sense datum in the illusion case, is not a composite of the wall and something yellow, a yellow sense datum, then its opacity is not going to give us grounds for the exclusion assumption. So at this point, the arguer from illusion has much more argumentative work to do, I think. I'm on the final page now. So there are a few things they could try to support. One is that is a claim about this sense datum in Bob's case. They could try to say, well, look, it's not a composite object that's composed of an ordinary object, the wall, and some yellow sense datum. It's just not like that. Well, why think that? That the tools that the sense datum theorists have so far employed are reflections on experience and the phenomenal principle. But that won't get you this claim that D is not a composite object. Again, they might say even more boldly, there are no such composite sense data. But their tools don't get you that either. Or they might say, whenever we're aware of such composites, we're not aware of their ordinary object component. Again, the tools they have, reflections on experience, the phenomenal principle, they simply don't get you these claims. The claims might be true, but they have the burden of supporting them. So then, just to summarize this aspect of the discussion, we got ourselves into a position where we noticed the argument from illusion was invalid, and so we needed to add an extra premise, the exclusion assumption. So that's in Bob's case, because Bob is aware of a yellow sense datum, he's not also aware of the white wall. Awareness of the yellow sense datum excludes awareness of the white wall. And we try to justify that by saying the sense datum he's aware of is opaque, and so given that he's aware of it in the region of space he would be aware of the wall, he's not also aware of the wall because it occludes it from view. And then I've just tried to undermine this opacity argument by saying, even if the sense datum is opaque, that doesn't mean it will occlude the wall, because the wall could be a part of it. It could be rather like the Rubik's Cube case. So the result then, I think, is, and this is the final point, the argument from illusion involves a premise that's not often recognized, but when we bring it out, we realize it's not just some trivial assumption that's been lying behind the argument. It's a substantive premise, like the other premises, that needs support. Thank you.